Welcome to Conductor's Brew. Matt, good morning to you, my friend, and thank you for having me back here in the front yard. How you doing, buddy?
Larry, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for coming back.
Well, of course. Where else are we going to do this?
I don't have a front yard. I am in a particularly good mood today because guess what happened to the backyard?
Oh, give us the update. Okay.
So, yes, we have this windstorm, right? And the tree that was leaning prior to the windstorm was leaning much more after the windstorm, and it got cut down this week. So it's no longer a safety hazard for everybody in about a 10-mile radius.
One can park on the street without fear of having a tree come through.
Yesterday or the day before, somebody came by to ground out the stump. I wasn't here. I don't know who it was, but it happened.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm quite impressed with that.
A full tree removal.
Full tree removal service. Yes.
All right. Are they going to plant the new tree?
I have no idea.
Celebrate Arbor Day.
I don't control the property. You know what? I just kind of go along with whatever they want to do.
Okay.
But I'm also pleased to say that my tomato plants have somewhat recovered from the storm. Yeah, and they're ripening once again.
Well, and you know, and we could have a special gardening special segment because this Brandon's back.
Oh,
Brandon's here.
Brandon, yes,
as well as other members of the crew. Brandon, we'll say just like Gilligan's Island. Brandon and the rest. I'm just kidding. we'll get to,
is that all we are?
No, you are first among equals, McKeever. All right,
he was the only one on time today.
That's true. You get extra coffee.
I sat in my car for a little bit, actually.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's just sad, man.
It is.
Well, we can clearly see who the responsible graduate student in the conducting program
Indeed.
Is. We'll get to our guests later.
Yeah. Later is in like 30 seconds.
Later is in a few seconds. Yeah. But we got to talk about the brew of the day.
Oh, my goodness.
Matt, what are we drinking?
You know, there's many fine things in life. Hmm. I have to say that Ethiopian coffee is one of them.
Okay.
Yeah. So last time I splurged. I didn't splurge. It was fairly reasonably priced for this local. Oops. Hang on. Those are the beans. This local craft roasted and hand packaged in on Antelope Drive in Layton, Utah, Daily Rise Coffee. I can verify that this is the second great bag that I've had. Roasted on the 9th of September. It's an Ethiopian Guji variety. And I can't think of a finer coffee, frankly. I did mess it up a little bit this morning. I put a little too many grounds in the French press, and so there's a few extra grounds. It didn't all get filtered out.
Yeah.
So I apologize for that if it's a little gritty.
Well,
but the flavor is just incomparable.
It is, and
it's like blueberries.
Yeah, I can taste the blueberries, and it's really bold. Like, it's got a lot of flavor to it, but it's got this kind of smooth, kind of creamy feel to it. I don't know what to say, but it's
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome.
Mm.
It's awesome.
Almost tastes like it has cream and sugar in it.
Yeah, that's exactly
it's
right.
It's amazing.
It's exactly right.
It's just a medium roast. No cream, no sugar. It's black coffee.
All right, man.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Anybody else want to chime in on the coffee?
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Fabulous.
Fabulous. And you made it the French press.
Yeah, well, sort of. I did an ad hoc French press where I take a big mason jar. Because my French press is tiny. It's a one-person French press.
Okay.
Which it works great for me, you know, if I'm being selfish. But in this larger, not larger, it's a sort of a communal gathering. All 6 feet spaced, by the way.
Yes. If our voices are a little quiet.
Yes.
Because we're all spaced out from the mic a bit more than usual.
I took a big mason jar and threw the grounds in it and simply used that as a French press and then strained the grounds out. Yeah.
Yeah. When are you going to roast some more coffee?
Yeah, I got to do that. Time's been a little tight the last couple of weeks.
Get out your bubble thing. What is it?
Oh, yes, the siphon.
The siphon.
Yeah. I need to grab the siphon.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not at this locale, per se.
Oh, I see. Yes. Oh, I see. Yes. It's on tour.
It's on tour at the moment.
It's visiting friends.
It's so popular, it's visiting friends. No, I made some of this Ethiopian in the siphon, and it tasted like plants. But the blueberry was even stronger. It tasted even more like fruit.
Yeah.
But it had this really kind of vegetal. I keep using that word vegetal with the siphon. It really does bring out the greener. I want to say the greener, more plant like aspects of the
chlorophyll ish.
I don't know. Well, I mean the coffee's brown. I don't know if there's any chlorophyll left in that. But
well, it is a plant.
It is a plant, and it absorbs all the nutrients.
I know that much about plants. Well, anyway, Matt, thank you once again for bringing us delicious food. I mean, delicious drink.
Hey, coffee is food.
it can be.
Seriously, well, Brendan, what is food? Cherry drink?
I was going to say anything you consume.
So I didn't ask Brendan about the coffee because Brendan doesn't have any coffee.
Yeah.
But Brendan, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking cherry flavored water.
Okay.
Ah.
So right. It looks
like one of those like the little
electrolyte. Is that
yeah. And you make that yourself, okay. Or is that a brand there?
No, I mixed it myself.
Oh, okay.
Is it like one of those droplets?
Shake in the little powder and
oh, okay. Okay,
yeah, give yeah. it a spin so I get a nice... Because you have to get a really good tornado whirl inside the bottle, so if it doesn't really spin right, it's not quite...
So you're nice. In charge of the brew of the day next time you realize this, right? You're going to make us all... I don't even know what it is. Yeah, I don't even...
packets of water.
We don't actually know that if you say what's in that bottle is actually in that bottle. It could be something else.
You're saying this might be a moonshine-like water?
Well, you know, let's just say we're going to have to shift the podcast to the afternoon at some point, and we can sure. You know, to a respectable drinking hour.
That's right.
And we can make that work. I've got some limoncello around somewhere still.
All right.
Yeah, that okay. is bootleg. Bootleg limoncello. Yeah.
Well,
I didn't say that, by the way. No. You can edit that out, right? No, don't edit that out. I'm proud of the limoncello.
Fair yeah. enough. We you know, we don't give the address here, so yeah. The G-Men aren't going to
come. A lot of memories of the limoncello.
Oh, I did want to point out, too. Oh, the limoncello. Yeah, yeah. We do have a lot of memories from the limoncello. It's a great pre-pandemic memories, and we were sharing a lot of limoncello in the house here. Maybe we'll have to have them on.
Yeah,
and,
we should.
Yeah, we should have them on at some point. I'll tell you later, Larry. It's
okay.
A good story. You might have been there that night, actually. This might have been a pizza party.
Could have been.
I don't know. Anyway, speaking of Pizza Palooza.
Oh, yes. It's time for
Repapalooza.
That's right.
Part the third? The fourth?
Well, we're going to maybe say last time was 1.5 because it was the same session. We just
okay.
we edited it out. So this
what
is,
are we on, 0.6?
No, this is 2.
2.
This
okay.
is Repapalooza 2.
So we round up the 2.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Sure.
Never mind.
Sure.
Coffee's still kicking in.
Fair yeah. enough.
Okay.
But the point is we've got the crew back here in the front yard, and we're talking more about Rep. And Matt, you have sort of taken the point on this today's episode and
yeah.
chosen the Rep for us to discuss. This
yes.
is a like a compulsory skate, like in the Olympics, where they
yes.
all have to do the same routine.
Well, not quite, because in
okay.
the Olympics, they're organized about it.
Oh,
I see.
They
know what they're doing.
And it makes sense what
yes,
they're
it
supposed
makes sense.
To do.
So I have simply taken... This is literally what I did this week, was I thought, you know what? Fifth Symphony.
Okay. You know?
Who do I know who's written a Fifth Symphony? Oh, yeah, Beethoven.
Mozart.
Schubert.
Oh yeah,
Mozart.
Mozart
make the list. I mean,
Mozart
was probably what? 10?
I wrote a fifth. I'm sure.
You know, I was trying to find like mature, quote unquote, mature
right.
works. Yeah.
Yes.
So we've got Beethoven 5 from 1808.
And by the way, I've got to say the one problem I have
yeah.
with this.
Oh god.
No Brahms 5.
I
well,
thought about that.
Isn't that the first piano concerto?
Well, technically, the fourth symphony is fifth because the German Requiem came before the symphonies.
Which could have been a symphonic. Corals
yeah, it was conceived. It's conceived as a symphonic structure.
Yeah.
I think
I had a problem with the program too. I didn't see my name in it.
Oh,
I
where's
right
you, have you
there.
Read the Fifth Symphony?
No, I don't have.
Oh, in the repertoire list? Oh, you bum! You don't have 5 symphonies.
No, I don't.
Write a Fifth Symphony and then we'll talk.
Nice.
Just skip 1 through 4.
Yeah,
just go right to 5.
Just call it 5.
No, but in the interest of fairness, we did want to have a composer on the panel today.
Good.
Okay.
Are we, have we actually introduced... We know these people.
I don't think we did.
Do people
on
radio...
Okay, one other thing
I
wanted to
say.
Okay. My voice is pretty clear. I mean, hey, people. I'm
yeah, we know who you are.
Yeah.
No, I did want to say that we got our first piece of fan mail today. Literally about an hour ago came in the mail. And... thank you, Dad.
which I was going to say is amazing because
my mom's a big fan of the podcast too, man.
It literally was a postcard.
But I can tell you,
awesome.
It's more than your dad and my mom listening. According to the downloads, so.
Larry, let me ask: how are we doing with the listening base? Is there?
Hey, it's growing every week.
Growing every week.
Yeah,
we're
getting folks listening.
But yeah,
no,
thank you for listening.
We have a couple fans in Wisconsin. I can tell you that.
Well, we've had some phone calls come in too to tell us how good you know. How good the show is.
We have a
again,
hotline.
Thank you, Dad. Yeah, we have got a hotline. No, but
can we
had a great suggestion.
Calls live on the air, like a call-in show.
We could have a call-in show.
Okay.
Yeah, we could
we'll
just
work
like
on
prank
that.
Call people and say, hey, you're on the show,
like Jerky Boys.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back.
Okay.
This
no.
is really always the cherry.
Last thing. I just wanted to plug this. Is our postcard writer had a great idea, which was to do a conductor's show.
This is a conductor's
well,
show.
Well, we hadn't thought of talking
oh,
about
oh,
other
talking
conductors.
About conductors.
Yes. Yeah.
I see.
So, yeah, he mentioned an anecdote in which his... Hang on, I got it right here.
Oh, yes, the development...
Yeah.
Yeah, you go
his
ahead, read
uncle.
It.
So this is my great uncle, Alphonse, growing up in New York City, went to go see Toscanini conduct either the NBC Orchestra or was it Columbia?
NBC
Symphony. Well,
NBC
was...
And, yeah, NBC, yeah. And I think Columbia was like made up of... Oh, I'm thinking of the wrong group. I don't know. Anyway, never mind. Yeah. So anyway, let's consider doing a show about the conductors of old, so to speak, and the development of the modern conductor. I think that's a great idea.
I think that'd be wonderful. And, you know, of course, Toscanini has a place of honor on this podcast. He's,
yes.
He's our lead into the rant.
It's a Toscanini postcard. He's right on the front.
I know. I felt judged as soon as I looked at that. He's he clearly thinks I'm not doing something correct.
This is, Ostank, I'm tired.
Yeah.
You go home and shut up now.
Okay. You can only get away with that because you're Italian.
Back to the Repapalooza.
Okay. So, anyway, but yeah, I think that'd be great because, I mean, I remember writing a paper about this at some point in graduate school, I think the first time, for the master's, and it's fascinating how conducting has evolved and changed over the years. Oh, we got a big truck coming through here.
You want to take a preemptive pause?
Okay, we'll take a pause here.
Take a pause.
Okay, we're back. Thank you for the heads up on the truck. Yeah. I'm trying to.
I can see it coming down the hill.
Yeah. All right. Good. So continue. So I was saying we're gonna. You know, it's fascinating how conductors how the careers evolved over the years. Yeah. It's a relatively new career in music. It's not something that's been around for very long. That'd be an interesting show. We should find somebody
who. In the
format
that it is now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you say exactly.
That's more or less a Wagnerian invention.
Well, I think it comes along before Wagner.
Well, I mean, in the form that it is now.
I think you see Mendelssohn doing that, though. He was kind of out in front early.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true.
But Wagner certainly did contribute a lot to our concept of conducting. You know, of course, he wrote the famous On Conducting book. So he has a hand in it, for sure. But yeah, it's one of those things that was you know greatly defined in the 19th century. So by the time we get to the great conductor of the 20th century, it's heavily influenced in Wagner, and we can spend a lot of time, and this may be a whole other show into itself, is the influence of sort of the Wagnerian concept of music on interpretations of earlier works from Beethoven. But I digress. So let's put a pin in that. Thanks, Papa Minella for the suggestion, and I think we'll do it.
Okay.
All right.
And thank you, Brandon and Ashkan and Matt, for being here for Repapalooza Part 2.
And this is officially Conductor's Brew with Larry, Matt, and crew.
Yeah.
Because the crew is here.
Matt, and Matt.
We might actually be able to skipper a scooter with this number of people. We could hit the high seas with this crew.
Yeah. You think I hit the Great Salt Lake there?
So here's what I have in mind.
A little salty.
There's some good sailing places out there, though.
Fair enough. Okay. Go ahead, Matt.
This is Controlled Chaos.
I don't know how controlled it
is. All right, so this is this is Symphony number 5, and I picked 7 symphonies, spanning from Beethoven's 5th in 1808 to Prokofiev's 5th in 1944. What I'd like to do is start at the top of the list and just go around quickly and do like 20-second bits of what's your favorite part of the symphony.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so jeez. 20 seconds, Beethoven 5, Brandon, go, what's your favorite part? doesn't have to be revolutionary.
No. Actually, you know, I think that change of not only mood and tempo, but that alteration that happens between the third and the fourth movement.
Ah! That was mine,
too. Of course it is. Of course it is.
I could say, well, the opening three notes.
Yeah.
No. It's the move from three to four.
It's that switch from three to four where all of a sudden the mood changes and, I mean, there's just something profound about that moment.
It explodes.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Awesome. And I have a quick comment. I'm just gonna jump in because
I bought
the mic. Okay. So
he's got a majority stake in what you're hearing right now.
Fair enough. But it's like I agree with you. That is my favorite part of that symphony. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
But what drives me nuts though is when people slow down into it.
Oh.
Yeah.
No. You just got to keep going. Yeah, I'm not gonna sing it for
like
you. But
a train that can't stop.
John, it's got to slam straight into it, but I can't stand it when people slow it down.
Have you seen that Harnoncourt video where he's rehearsing that and he talks about that very thing?
No.
It's great. You know, Harnoncourt, he's got this famous kind of period instrument and sound thing going. And his whole approach is like it just has to be revolutionary sounding. Like it has to be like this gigantic monster of freedom, if you will, that just explodes out of this mysterious primordial ooze of the end of the third movement, that transition.
That's amazing. Well, we're going to have a whole Beethoven show because it's, you know, his birthday is coming up. The 250th birthday is coming up in December. So we'll have a Beethoven show. We'll get into all of the good Beethoven arguments. Okay.
Ashkan.
Oh, yeah.
Favorite part.
This is one of those actually hardest questions, though. Because
I know.
You know, like, I don't really like to point out any
Hold up.
Part.
Puppies.
Hold up. Okay, we're back. We had a puppy break.
Yeah.
Being unplugged.
Go ahead.
The microphone.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I was,
sir.
I was just actually saying it's a little hard for me to point out any specific moment that I like. It's just how I am.
That's why you're here. Because I want this perspective. Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
it's fair.
But if there is if there's any moment that sticks in my mind for that symphony, I would say I like the way that the second theme actually comes in the first movement.
Mm.
I like that contrast, like you were talking about the contrast.
Bum, bum, bum,
yeah.
Bum,
and then how different it is, although we have the motif going on. The background.
Yeah, that's a great point, though, because it's a transition, like it really does transition from da-da-da-dum to something else. Da 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 da.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I like that moment a lot. I also like the horns. I don't know what movement it is that they actually replicate the motif. Yeah, I like that moment too. Yeah, is that the third movement?
That's the.
I forgot.
It comes back in the.
Yeah,
that's
the beginning of
the
third movement.
Yeah, the theme from the third movement. Yeah, I like that too. So, anyways.
Great, McKeever.
You know, mine. I'm actually going to say in the second movement. You know. He has this part in the second movement where he does this ya da 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 bum ba, and the last time he does this ba da 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 dee da.
Yeah.
And actually I think to me it's a play off of something he did in Eroica, where the second time that you have this da da dee dee dee, good save. Da da dee da 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 dee dee dee.
Oh yeah.
It's like he has this tiny little like sunrise, you know, little like just a very 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 moderate effect. And I don't know, for some reason to me that just little change is kind of like makes my heart sparkle.
Oh, it's the details
for a little bit.
Beautiful, thank you.
I already went.
Oh,
yeah, I jumped. I seconded Brandon's moving from third movement to fourth movement.
Okay, then I guess it's my turn then.
Yeah.
All right, second movement.
What is your favorite?
Dum, ba, bum, 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 bum. You know, that great martial theme from the second movement. The accompaniment changes from triplets to 16th notes. Da da dee da da dee da da to da ka 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 da, whatever it is. And it's those little details. I mean, Mozart did that in some respects. I'm not sure about Haydn, but Beethoven really loves to bring out those differences in when he reprises material, and I think it's great. The little detail.
Awesome. Schubert.
Schubert 5.
Schubert.
Okay. Yeah. Which somebody was playing on their phone before we started the show.
I played a little bit because Larry was talking.
All the brand new get to go first.
Larry was humming it.
All right, now not this time. It's not what's your favorite part.
Oh gosh,
yeah.
I'm gonna change it on a game show.
This is why it's organized chaos.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Okay.
What is the most whimsical moment for you? Let's go backwards, Larry. You're laughing. So let's go.
Why I gotta go with the whimsical?
No,
I already had a favorite. Okay.
Okay.
So I have a good answer for this whimsical too.
Okay.
If it's my whimsical moment, I'm gonna smack you.
No, the whimsical's a bad word. I gotta be honest. I made that up in like the last 20 seconds. So, favorite part, Larry. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, my favorite part, I will say, is the second movement.
Okay.
And we were discussing. Yeah, yeah.
No,
we were
discussing.
It's not it.
No.
Okay. It's second movement, slow movement, and we were discussing whether this should be in two or it should be in six. And McKeever, you're making an argument for six, which I would look forward to hearing. And I feel like it, you can do it in six, and it sounds beautiful. And I think when I did it years ago, I probably did do it in six, but it's been a while since I've done it again. But I like it in two because it gives it kind of a dance feel. But you can also kind of just sort of get a new, completely different feeling if you go slower in six.
Yeah.
And it also still sounds really beautiful, but it feels like a different kind of a piece almost.
It does, and I think you know true. For me, I do kind of treat Schubert with a little bit of the romanticism that I treat Brahms with, and you know if I'm thinking in comparison with the slow movement of the fifth, the slow movement of the eighth, and the slow movement of the ninth, I mean I like them you know a bit slower because I think that they do have sort of that romantic character to them. That's
Well, that's what's interesting. So interesting about it is, like, you know, because Schubert, we always think of him, he's on this cusp, right, mm-hmm. between the two.
Yep.
And there's a lot of romantic qualities in the Fifth and a lot of his other works. But the Fifth, to me, sounds so very classical to me.
It does.
And so that's why
it's
feel
so
like
lyrical too.
Yeah. Well, that's Schubert melody stuff. True.
But I'll tell you this. Gorgeous. You know, if we're going to talk about our favorite moments or what we think is like most interesting or whimsical or whatever, you know, it's the fact that the recapitulation in the first movement is in E flat and not in B flat.
Oh,
yeah.
I don't think I've noticed that.
Yeah,
well,
it's interesting because I think he has this way of bringing you know themes back, but then bringing them back, especially in like a recapitulatory manner, in not bringing them back in the original key.
Yeah,
and I attribute that also to the last movement of the Ninth Symphony, when you know he brings back the. The first time we have it in C major, and then we have it in E flat.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, but
way to bring the musicology there.
But when he's writing the symphony, this is a time where he's really obsessed with Mozart. He's looking back.
Yeah.
So even the instrumentation is much lighter.
It is,
And it's very Mozartian. It's almost like Mozart's 40th without the clarinets. It's mm-hmm. very similar instrumentation style with what's going on at this time, and so I think, you know, they're not that far removed, but definitely you can, I think you get a sense of this light, different playfulness that's in a more Mozartian vein.
Yeah, especially the opening of the first movement. I mean, it's just so light and
beautiful, quick little intro.
Happy.
I mean, that's very Mozartian.
Yeah, it really is.
So this really is kind of a throwback to, he's thinking a lot about Mozart.
And that little opening theme, it always reminds me of like people in powdered wigs like bowing at each other, getting ready to start some sort of a dance or something. It's so light Viennese.
Every time I'm
happy
on this podcast, Larry, I have my wig with me.
Wait,
that's why
you have it?
That's why I wear the wig.
Oh, okay. Well, I appreciate that.
Just looked at my score. For the viewing audience.
For the viewing audience.
I actually wrote in here, wrong key for recapitulation.
There you go.
So I guess I did notice.
But I forgot. You noticed.
It's the wrong key? Well, tell Schubert that.
Well, yeah.
How dare he?
You know,
I don't understand what the
send him a letter.
Wrong key isn't, it's different than
different.
Yeah.
Okay. I got you.
Ashkan, Brandon, any more comments on Schubert 5?
Nah, I think I'm good.
Okay.
Yes.
He doesn't have his wig.
Well, I guess comment. I didn't say anything about that one, but that's okay. Mendelssohn 5.
Oh. Okay.
This is the quote-unquote
Reformation
Symphony.
Let me pull that.
Matthew, this isn't your favorite, is it?
No, I actually really do like this one.
I thought you didn't like this
one. No, I do like this one. You know, it's very interesting for something that's supposed to be so uplifting, and it really is at the end. It really does get kind of uplifting.
Growl.
That the first movement, man,
yeah.
Boy, does that sound a bit disturbed.
It is.
Yeah.
It sounds like Wagner before Wagner.
Yeah.
It's the you know, the dark days before the Reformation, I guess.
Well, you know why.
Wow. Well,
it starts with the very beginning, it starts with the Dresden Amen.
Oh.
Don't ask me to tell you any more about
it. Okay. Drop the Dresden Amen and don't expand on it? Come on,
but
now.
No, it's beautiful. It starts
like
with
an EDM term? The Dresden Amen? Yeah.
No, it starts with this beautiful... It's got this unison D in the low strings that just, it has this beautiful expansion, harmonic expansion,
yeah,
that sounds like Wagner to me. It sounds like something from Parsifal, like an introduction of Parsifal. And then it's interrupted by this distant fanfare that is like this solemn procession, if you will. It's all very churchy from the very beginning. Mm-hmm.
Well, if I can just jump in here.
Please.
I mean, of course, I love his handling of A Mighty Fortress. I mean, it's just, it's the way he does the chorale at the end, the last movement. It's really gorgeous. And like the, sort of the subito piano. You know, it kind of gets quiet at the end. But my favorite part of it when I did this, because I did it in 2017 for the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. But a lot of people probably did that.
I think I did too, actually.
Yeah, I mean, good time to do it. But it's the movement. Yeah. I think it's the third movement, if I'm not remembering incorrectly. It's sort of like a happy.
The Andante.
It's like a happy. It reminds me of like the Lutherans out at a covered dish somewhere, you know, because having a party and just enjoying themselves. It just feels so. There you go. It just feels so light and happy and joyous. I don't know. It's I always found it very charming.
That I had something to say about it. When I was listening to it, actually I was listening to it last night, and I think it's the most strange one, like, yeah, out of all the...
Yeah, titles, definitely. Yeah.
And one thing is, I sort of, like, figured out, it reminded me Ives' unanswered question a lot.
Oh!
Yeah, somehow. I mean, the contrast between that Fanford...
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, I don't know why, but every time I was listening to it, I was like, it sounds like Ives. Well, obviously Ives comes after.
Yeah.
His symphony, it sounded really modern to me.
I agree. All of them. That's an interesting connection, though, because with this being focused on sort of these Lutheran themes and church themes, and you have Ives, who was brought up in a church tradition and surrounded by that influence and style.
Yeah, his father...
Church hymns and...
Yeah, his father was a church organist, I think.
Yeah, so it's an interesting connection you're thinking about.
Okay. Yeah, it's kind of a... so when you were performing it, it's... like, how do you bring... Because I know, like, in Ives, you can do a lot of, like, offstage stuff, and there are a lot of, you know, in orchestration.
Yeah.
There's a lot you can do to sort of, like, create that contrast, really, like, put a lot of weight on that contrast.
Mm.
But is there anything that you did to bring that up, like, that contrast, like, in measure, what is it? Measure 8 that the piano comes back?
In the first movement or last movement?
Yeah, first movement.
First movement.
I didn't do anything like kind of special staging or anything like that. No,
I'm not talking about staging. I wasn't just as far as like performing it. Because like it's definitely a different moment, and it's like if you just perform it the way it's written, I would say yeah, I'll do it. But musically speaking, like these are two different types of music that are juxtaposed.
Mm-hmm.
So. I was wondering if, like, anything special you did when you were performing, not off staging or anything like that.
Nothing that comes to mind. I just, you know, probably would have done whatever I needed to enhance the contrast there. But no, nothing comes to mind that I remember doing.
I remember a few years ago, which was that it took a lot of rehearsal to get this beginning right.
Yeah.
The introduction especially. Yeah, because of those antiphonal things happening between the strings and then the brass. And the brass and the winds have these messy voces, this crescendo and diminuendo on the same half note.
Yeah.
It's just bum, 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 which is like, how do you do that? What does he mean? I think it's really supposed to just be like this distant thing, like like the strings are close and present, and then the brass and winds are like, you know, on the other side of the cathedral kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to sound that way. And then once the players, this was Campus Symphony that I did it with, once they kind of got that conception of it, they're like, oh, I see. You know, like it has to sound like it's reverberating before it even gets to the sound of, you know, close.
Yeah.
What's so funny?
Matt's melting down over
Matt
there.
Matt and Brandon are having a moment.
That's an off-mic comment.
Okay.
We can talk about
it. But if I was...
They have their super twins.
Honestly.
Communication going on here.
Oh, yeah. With these beautiful... Yeah, these contrasts.
Yeah. I would just go with pianissimo.
Well, I love the ascending string stuff that goes from pianissimo all the way up to crescendo to another pianissimo. Like subito pianissimo. And that does sound just like Parsifal. It's the same gesture because Wagner quotes the Dresden Amen in Parsifal as well. So yeah, it's just got these. Oh man, this distant martial effects. Yeah, contrasted with the very lyrical kind of close procession. Like there's this close fanfare, there's a distant fanfare, and then there's procession happening in the strings, and it's all just so strange because it's like, is this the beginning of the symphony? Is it the introduction?
Allegro doesn't come.
I don't know if you had a particular recording that you referenced, but I discovered this recording of the entire Mendelssohn collection done by Yannick and the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, which is just phenomenal. If you get a chance to listen to it, it's amazing.
Yeah.
He adds, there's like a fourth movement, and then like the fourth movement is like a fifth movement. So there's like this added music that I don't know where it came from, in that recording. And I don't know if it's maybe like a precursor to the movement. But
see if I put anything in my score about it.
It was very. It was really interesting to hear that there was something that was kind of sort of played by the orchestra that wasn't in a score that I had seen or another recording that I had heard before.
Hmm. Like before the chorale?
Yeah.
Huh.
Did you see like the score, like the manuscript or the autograph?
I didn't. No.
Yeah, I'd be curious about that.
All right, investigate and report back to us.
I will. Yeah. I will.
We'll have a special update.
You're not going to be invited again.
That's right. If you don't come back with this information, you know what? You're not allowed.
I'll stand over there. And just listen.
All right.
All right.
We can skip. Take his
call. You want to skip about 50 years or so?
All right. Let's warp forward.
Tchaikovsky 5.
Oh, yeah. Oh gosh.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I didn't appreciate the symphony for a long time. Mm. You know, I kind of felt like Tchaikovsky 5 didn't rival Tchaikovsky 4 or Tchaikovsky 6. And then I performed it, and I'm like, gosh,
oh, it's great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So awesome.
Yeah.
It's so cathartic.
Yeah.
It just goes on and on and on, and then when you don't think it can anymore, it changes the tempo and the time. And it becomes something else.
And yeah, it ends about four times.
Yeah, it does.
That's about four endings.
Bacoda. Yeah.
And getting to that last E major, I mean, that is just, that is a heavenly experience, if there really is.
Bum, bum, bum,
bum. You know, and I was actually going to ask you this, Matt. I mean, have you've either performed this or conducted this?
I think I've played trumpet in it.
Did you, you know, take it upon yourself to just follow the first violin line? Yum, bum, 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 bum. Because I had my principal trumpet do that.
Oh.
Which part are you talking about?
It's at the end.
It's at the end of the last movement.
Yeah.
It's right before yum, ba-dum, 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 ba-dum.
Yes.
Before, like, ending number three or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Get there.
It's like,
are you talking about this part?
Couldn't figure out how you want to end it.
Oh wait, that's the six.
Well, while you're searching for that, I love this sound. I've done it three times, and I've always found something that really has energized me and made it come back fresh. But of course, I mean the second movement, the horn solo. I mean that's just got to be one of the most gorgeous romantic solos in my opinion.
So
movement horn solo
before the presto.
That reminds me of. A story that I will tell momentarily.
Yeah, oh, Matt, is this the lights out? Yes, okay.
Matt, I see what you're saying now. Yeah, the presto, the coda in the last movement, yeah, that trumpet line, it stays down on, what, the G instead
Tom,
of the...
Pom, 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 pom. Yeah, I don't know.
What key are those parts written in? B-flat?
We're getting in the weeds now.
Yeah, oh, gosh.
Talking about transposed trumpet parts.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are in B-flat.
Are they? So that would be what? I, C?
Yeah, well, you would go... Yeah, I mean, concert B. So C-sharp.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I guess it would help if I was in the right key. Yeah. Yeah, so this reminds me, actually, Larry, you mentioned the horn solo of the slow movement. We had a fantastic horn player, graduate student at the Philharmonia, the Utah Phil, at the school. So we're playing the concert, and he's playing a solo, just finished it, and the power goes out.
Dramatic.
Lights off. Totally off. Not even any emergency lights for a few seconds.
At least he got all the way through the solo.
Yeah, he did.
That's good.
And then we got you know, out into, like, the strings after that, and then the lights went off, and that was it. And the emergency lights came on, we did some investigating, and turned out there was some issue somewhere on campus. All of campus was down. Mm-hmm. So we had to end the concert.
Wow.
Yeah, and so we planned to reprise this concert, and we did it, I think, a few weeks later, and I played a little trick on the group. When we were on stage one day, they were rehearsing, and in the middle of Dr. Baldwin saying something, I was backstage and I turned all the lights on.
Oh, yeah.
And he knew it was me right away. I have no idea how he knew it was me.
Man,
he says, Matt.
Oh, man. I tell you what.
The orchestra got a good laugh out of it.
Maybe in year three of my TA I would have done that, but I wouldn't have done that in year two.
No, I wanted to lighten the mood. We're all a little stressed because of that. And, you know. Anyway,
you gotta have it.
Yeah, you gotta, yeah. But I've seen some train wrecks happen with this symphony. Not with this group, no. It never happened with our group. Dr. Walton did a really great job leading the students through that. But I've seen issues in that transition in the last movement.
Mm-hmm.
I will
Well, there, there, I got to tell you, there's the, a very famous, difficult part is those, are those triplets. And getting them to actually sound like triplets. Where the... And it's this string, and it's going under...
Because
they
offbeat thing?
Well, it's because they're not complete... They're just the second and third eighth note of the triplet pattern.
So it never lines up, and
it's always kind of wonky. It's a difficult one to kind of get settled. I've been able to get it so that it works well enough, but it's always kind of a fluffy spot.
I will tell you, Matt, that I definitely made, when I conducted this, I made a very critical error.
Uh-oh.
And I slowed down the bar before the presto.
Oh.
Which you shouldn't do, because the first violins are...
You know, like, oh, yes, they're... On the 16th. Yep. They're playing 32nd notes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jump. You know, sometimes the mood catches you in the way, and then I'm referencing my video afterwards, and I'm just like, wow.
I was thinking more
that's not great.
The following transition to the molto manimoso. Because it changes from 144 equaling the half note to 96 equaling the dotted half note.
Jeez.
Which isn't quite a metric conversion.
It's not.
It's just a little bit slower than a metric conversion. Mm-hmm. One thing, and that's all to say that it's a little tricky. You have to be really assertive there. But one thing I want to draw attention to is the dynamic markings. Everybody is at what, double forte, triple forte, sempre triple forte. But at that transition,
five Fs.
Yeah.
There's two groups of instruments that have then four Fs, a dynamic level above the rest of the orchestra. Yeah, the trumpets, which you can always hear, and the oboes, which you can never hear, which I think is interesting.
It has to be coordinated with the oboes. It's absolutely useless for that marking. I really think it is.
Yeah, it gets a little crazy with the Fs there.
It gets a little crazy, yeah. But that's an interesting point, too, is it's all relative. It's a range, right? Mahler does the same thing, where he's got like five Fs. And Holst in the Planets does the same thing, too, I think. It's just crazy.
He does.
Yeah.
You know, but that's like you know, if you look at, gosh, you have a score for it, Matt.
Yeah.
Tchaikovsky 4, the opening. What mm-hmm. is it? Is it? It's horns.
And, oh yeah.
Horns and bassoons.
Bassoons. Yep.
I mean, do you ever hear the bassoons?
I don't. And they're all marked at the.
And actually. Going back to Beethoven 5, it's strings and clarinets. I mean, do you ever hear the clarinets?
No.
Nope. But it's a color thing, you know?
Yeah. It's there.
Yeah.
It's there. All right. So, any other comments on the Chike 5?
Negatory.
All right. I'm just going to put another shout out for that.
And that was pretty good.
And I've
been
fortunate that I've always had great principal horn players when I've done it. Whew. I mean, you have to. You can't. Because that horn solo is just it's exposed, but when it's played right, it's just gorgeous.
Nerves of steel.
Okay, moving on then.
Fast forwarding to Mahler 5. Another 14 years. Oh, it's only 14 years difference. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that. 1888, Chike 5. Towards the end of his life. And Mahler 5, 1902. Also kind of towards the end of his life. Really. Alright. Let's talk about Mahler's insistence on funerals. Okay. First movement. Is it a concerto for trumpet or not?
Yeah.
Yeah. Says the trumpet player in the room at the right time. No. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it starts with this da-ka-da-dum, da-ka-da-dum. And I realized later that that's a great way to kind of come back to this motivic thing, because it sounds it's just like the beginning of Beethoven's.
I was just going to say that.
Except the notes stay the same.
And then it goes up.
And then it goes up. Ba-ba-ba-ba. Yeah.
Tchaikovsky does that too at the beginning. But
oh, really?
Yeah. Isn't it like it goes up? It's the same motif in a way, like short.
I can't honestly think of it at the moment.
Yeah.
Oh, I've got a score right in front of me.
So the beginning of Chike 5?
Yeah.
Bum, ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba.
Sort of like.
A little
bit.
Anyways.
Yeah. Well, you talk about Mahler and funerals. I mean, there's definitely an obsession with death.
Oh, man.
And dying. And
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's an obsession or if it's a concern, because it was always part of his life.
Yeah.
Was death around him. And yeah. And I don't know if, I think there was probably an element that sort of terrified him, and maybe this was his way of dealing with some of those feelings, was just putting it to music. Getting it out that way.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you look at the Resurrection Symphony, you know, the second. It's a lot with that. And, of course, I mean, like you mentioned the tragedies in his own life.
Yep.
And then the cycle with Kinder Totenlieder,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, yeah, it's definitely... And, by the way, this could be completely wrong, so feel free to correct me.
Yeah, this is all my speculation.
Well, no, but I was going to say, not about this.
Oh, you're not about... What about you're going to say?
Yeah, but never accuse
you of being wrong.
That Mahler was actually... was going to go and go and have some sessions with Sigmund Freud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that he did have the sessions.
He had sessions. And he told him, you're fine.
you're good.
Yeah.
Keep writing
symphony. It's a mother obsession. Right. It's all about mother.
I didn't think he actually had the sessions. I thought he was supposed to.
Yeah,
I don't know how many they walked.
Yeah.
They did
get together.
Because it's all part of that whole, the 19th century kind of, obsession with the dark side of humanity and kind of the inner self and the self-reflection and the...
Well, so I've thought about Mahler a little bit because of that, and I wondered, I don't know enough about his life in detail to know if he was like a full-on obsessive compulsive or if he was a control freak or, if there was... I don't know. I think, I assume that he... liked being in control of a lot of things, and death is one of those things that you can't control, and that must have just terrified him, because you look at how he wrote the symphonies and all of the level of detail and instruction that is put into everything, and the care with how he's instrumentationing, is that a word? How he's writing for the instruments and where he's inserting them and taking them out. Like, there's so much level of care and interest in that.
Yeah.
And he's very, very careful about that. And so I sometimes wonder, that had to have been a reflection of his own personality. But,
and I'm thinking, that you're saying this, he was trying to cheat it, too.
Absolutely. When he found out about his heart issue.
Because he wrote Das Lied von der Erde,
As the Ninth Symphony.
As the Ninth Symphony, and then wrote the Ninth Symphony, and then he...
Yeah, so he didn't work.
Then he completed the Adagio from 10, and then he died.
Which is some of my favorite music ever written, by the way.
The Adagio from 10,
I consider it an extension of the Ninth Symphony
in
a lot of ways. Ashkin and I have talked about this at length.
I also consider it an extension of the first.
The first
symphony? Yeah.
Whoa.
He's so fixated on the note A.
Yeah.
I read, a lot of about the fright chord that he writes at the very beginning of the fifth movement of the
second symphony.
Yeah, and how it's very comparable to, the fright chord at the beginning of the
last movement of 9.
Exactly, for Beethoven.
B flat to the A, is that what it is?
But then it's really, really, really interesting. You hear these fright chords that happen in the orchestra in the Adagio from 10, and you just have this trumpet player just piercing an A through all of that. It's just like...
It sounds like an organ
when someone gets pissed off, I don't know about you, but I'm a terrible pianist, so I get... play something on the piano, I screw something up, and I just go... And it's like, that's
what it sounds like, right? Just taking your arms and throwing the whole forearms down onto the piano.
And then the A key sticks.
It's a cipher. It's like the one thing that won't go away.
Yeah.
The one certainty in life
He's
is
talking
death.
About the trumpet one.
Maybe that's what he did in his piano in his little hut. The A was broken.
Maybe. But you think about his introduction to the symphony. And I don't want to talk about the other music that preceded the symphony. But the first bit of the first symphony.
Oh yeah.
There it is.
To me, that reminds me of the beginning of the Ninth Symphony. This is how the night starts.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Beethoven.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, back to his fifth symphony.
I'm really playing right now because now I'm going to think
since
about
all we're
of
this. I mean, hey,
peanut gallery, cut it out over there. What are you doing?
I think the fifth symphony probably is the most, it may be next to the second, it's probably the most programmed.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's pretty easily accessible to a lot of groups. It's not super complicated.
And four. I guess.
Like some of the other ones are. And it certainly doesn't have the size of some of the other ones. Well,
that's a really good point. That's something I wanted to bring up was...
But
was
so,
yeah, go ahead.
I guess my point with that is there's a... Even though it is Mahler and it's like middle of his development of as a composer, like it's, you know, it's, he knows what he's doing at this point for sure. But I think there's an inherent simplicity to it.
Mm.
And even if you listen to it, it's not... I haven't found it to be overly complex.
Mm.
Certainly there are moments where there's a lot to be worked out as far as
dealing
with the orchestra on it. But there's a simplicity to it and a sweetness. And, of course, you hear that in the Adagietto more than anything. But
which everybody always does too slow.
Yeah. But
thanks, Bernstein.
But there's just this thing to it. And maybe it's Alma's influence, I don't know, you know, or his thinking about her during this time.
You're right. It does have a kind of a tender-heartedness to it.
It's a little bit different.
It's, I think of it kind of as a transitional work, whereas where one is kind of large scale, it is, there's a lot of brass. Two is huge. Three is huge. Four is like the complete opposite.
It is.
That's the last symphony that he does that's like that. That's like that minimal, almost a classical instrumentation.
Yep.
Five is sort of like the beginning of like a second set, I think. Five, six, seven, eight, nine.
I'm sorry, I'm going to disagree with you, man.
Oh, here we go again, man. Here we go again.
I am.
Throw down.
There, you need the
throw
sound effects
there. Throw in the glove.
Fight!
Oh, I'm sorry, man. We're out of time, by the way. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm almost out of coffee.
Yeah.
So, I actually think... You know, so one thing, Brandon, I think that it's kind of interesting that you point this out. You know, this really is the only the second work that he's done that is purely instrumental at this point.
Oh.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Include okay. Well,
First symphony.
Yeah.
And then, you know, everything
else. Yeah,
because
it was all songs that he was doing these big orchestral sets.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Huh. You see, I think that one and two are paired together.
Okay.
And then I think that...
Why?
So... There is this discussion on, you know, when he wrote the first movement of two, there's a program element that goes along with
the Totenfeier.
Yeah,
yeah.
There's a program element that goes along with the first symphony about a hero. And then the Totenfeier is the death of the hero.
Yeah.
And then you could have the resurrection of the hero. And I think that those are it's like if you broke this up into like, you know, stories, one and two tell a story. Mm. I think three, four, and five tell a story.
Mm.
I really do.
I think there's a case to be made for that.
There is.
He's always stealing from himself anyway, and there's thematic material that goes from three to four to five.
So,
da-ga-da-dum, for instance.
The original concept of three was supposed to have seven movements, and the song that's at the end of four is supposed to be that seventh movement.
Okay.
And you hear it when they have the hymn. Da da dee da 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 da. It's taken from three. And it's inserted into four.
I didn't know that.
The first movement of four
is
the first time you have any hint of the Tower March. Because he has the... Dum, so, I don't know. I think that he's then taking that and he's, you know...
Yeah.
It's like there's...
The seed for five.
Correct.
Yeah.
But then it ends anyway. D major, yo. I mean...
It's these weird progressive tonal schemes that... I like them. Actually, Ashkan, that's a good question.
Mm.
We've talked about this before. You know, like, if a symphony starts in C sharp minor and then ends in D major or something, do you think the audience notices that
no,
long-term...
No, actually, I mean, if you have perfect pitch or you're a trained musician, like, studies show that you can probably recognize that, but for just lay audience...
Subconsciously, even?
Hard to say. I'm not sure about subconscious. Like, I don't think you can measure subconscious.
How would we study that, if possible?
Yeah, I can't remember the details of the study, but it's just those are the psychophysical studies that they just introduce a index, and then they sort of measure that. Anyways, but yeah, there's a study. I can't remember even, but I can maybe bring it. I mean, I can just make.
I would love to do a show on like the latest neuroscience or the latest studies and related to music.
Maybe he talked to Freud about that in his sessions.
It's possible.
You never know. Freud's all about the subconscious.
I mean, is there anywhere that exists like Freud's notes on Molly?
Oh, that's a really good question.
I gotta think. There's some. If they're out there,
I feel
someone's
like I've read some. Yeah.
Freud's notes.
Yeah.
From his sessions with Molly.
Yeah.
Or at least a violation.
That's something I wanted to say.
Did they have that then?
I don't know. Go back to Purple Club.
That's right.
I wanted to say a few things, because probably this symphony is really, he is pretty conscious about how it is connected to Beethoven's Five from the beginning. One thing that is really interesting for me, how he does it, because Beethoven Five, when I listen to it, the most interesting part for me is how he's trying to make a movement out of a motif, right?
Four notes.
Yeah, and that was sort of revolutionary at the time. How much you can actually just rely on one motif and make a movement. And Mahler is doing the same thing in this symphony. And back to what Brandon was saying about dynamics and just sort of micromanaging, I think he has to do it in order to be able to create all these layers, you know. I think out of all these symphonies I've listened to, I think this is the most fragmented symphony that I heard out of all of them. And
of Mahler's or of the list?
No, of the list.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think it's just the next, basically Mahler saying, here's what I can do with the motif. And the way he does it is that he creates a lot of dynamic layers.
Okay.
With all these dynamic markings that they, each of them, and he's pretty conscious about it because he's a conductor and you know how to.
He was constantly altering things too.
Yeah. And we know, like in the studies, that just a change of dynamic can create a different stream of sound.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just put like mezzo forte for both two lines together, they're probably not going to sync with it.
Oh, you're right.
So, but if you just say mezzo forte this and maybe mezzo piano this one, then you create, you know, two different layers just with the dynamics.
That brings to mind a couple of moments specifically where he does that between the solo trumpet, which is basically like this concerto sound, and he has the trumpet alternating with other instruments, in particular the first violins, I think, in that first movement, where the sounds go, like the sound of the violins will go into the trumpet or vice versa. And then in later places too, I think he does the same thing with trombones and horns, where they kind of come in and out of each other's sounds really subtly. It's if you don't know what's happening, if you don't have the score in front of you, it's really hard to know what's going on. You just notice the timbre changing.
So like I think with all those instructions you were saying, I think he's trying really hard to maintain all these, like a lot of layers. I don't know how many, like how many layers can you hear, you know.
He's pushing that limit for
sure. I mean, just a new, I guess, new way of making counterpoints, like fourth dimensional
counterpoint. That sounds like a new class coming in.
I think Data wrote some of that in Star Trek. Some of his musical contributions, and then that in addition to playing the guitar in Star Trek.
Okay, moving on.
Time is getting short. Brandon
to the sun. Let's roll.
Yeah, no, I'm good at this.
He's a lizard.
Nice, unlike me, Brandon likes the sun.
I'm going on a hike after this.
Shostakovich 5. Oh, yeah, maestro hike today. Have a good time.
Yeah.
Shostakovich 5. Okay, the question. Last movement. Fast or slow?
Slow.
Fast.
Slow.
I love it. It's slow.
Yeah. It's slow. Okay. It's not Bernstein's tempo.
But Shostakovich loved that. He came up to Bernstein and said, "That's amazing. I hadn't thought to do it that way." Yeah.
Was that just his way of saying?
I don't know. I mean, like,
if you're Shostakovich, do you really think you're going to be intimidated by somebody like Bernstein?
He wasn't big about confrontation, though. He was a pretty shy character.
Yeah. So I mean, here's
my, I always like like to hear,
I have an
my
opinion about this, as like could imagine.
It's kind of
So it sounds energetic. It sounds peppy. I mean, I get that, but it ruins the whole kind of political message of the thing, you know, which was him being ironic, you know, the forced celebration, you will be happy, you know, what is it, that your business is rejoicing or whatever the quote was, I don't remember, but it blows it out of the water if you actually make it sound too happy.
I think
it's got to be ironic to make it work. In my opinion,
I agree with you. Actually, I think it has a lot more to say if we extend that pain and pleasure at the same time, so to speak, and doing it slowly. Okay. Well, let me back up a little bit. So this edition that I have, these Sikorsky editions, these nice hardbound collected works, the DSCH publishers from 2010. This is at rehearsal mark 131 for those of you with a score.
Reading along at home. I'll put that in the show notes.
That we're talking about. This is the famous transition that it can either go bum 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 or half as fast. Bum 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 bum. Okay. In this score, in this edition, it has marked an eighth note equals 184. Mm-hmm. That's the tempo marking. Not a quarter note equals 184.
That's correct.
So that, I think, is where the issue comes from, is a misunderstanding or misprinting of the tempo indication.
And
yeah, it's
correct me if I'm wrong,
but
I looked at the Bernstein scores New York Phil's website.
Oh, the digital, yeah.
Yeah, and I can't remember now, so maybe you, one of you guys, if you've seen it, but he puts in there, like, he corrects that, or he... there's something about that. You know what I'm talking about, or am I completely making this up?
I don't know it off the top of my head. Does anybody have that on their phone?
Go to
digital.
They're pictures of Bernstein scores.
Yeah,
that's the famous metronome mark controversy or the thing. But there's something. If you go back, there's evidence, and I remember I did this a long time ago. There's evidence that supports the slower tempo. Besides, just even in other words, it reinforces that the metronome mark should be eighth note. To the beat, not quarter note.
So
there's something in there. Yeah. I don't have the score, but
I'm gonna counter with something else. Not this relates. I promise.
Okay.
So there's actually a very 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 interesting tempo marking that happens in the first movement too. Mm. And Matt's score is going to be page 48 and 49.
Okay.
And I think that honestly a lot of conductors get this wrong. And I think that this right here actually sets up your tempo for what you need to do in the last movement. So he says, a tempo conduta forza.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this is taken at double speed all the time. In almost every single recording that I've ever heard and every single performance that I've ever seen of this. Because I think, you know, you get into this yum bum 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 beam bum 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 bum. What I really think this is bum 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 bee da da bum 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 bum. I think it's
bum bum.
Yeah,
that's slow.
It is. But,
I kind of like that.
Yeah,
but it's very haunting. Very haunting.
And let's back up because we should talk about the context of this piece.
Yes.
You know, we know what
I
this.
I have a lot of opinions.
But you know, just to set the stage about what this, what the justification for this is. So I mean, just briefly. So Shostakovich wrote this opera, Lady Macbeth.
Yeah,
and he was chastised, we'll put it that way, by the authorities, and had real fear for his life that he was going to be. They said it was not. Was it decadent or was it, they had a term for it? Formalist. I can't remember.
Well, I mean, are you saying like what the paper called it?
Well, yeah, with the criticism of
muddle instead of music.
Okay, yeah, that was the article or something. But anyway, he was basically saying, you know, you have to write something that has this socialist realism that glorifies the state and all that kind of stuff. And so the Fifth Symphony was his musical attempt at getting sort of, you know, redeeming himself.
An artist's response to just criticism.
Correct, that's what he wrote, yeah. And so he wrote this Fifth Symphony, you know, with this, you know, heroic triumphant ending. And we should point out that there's also the what is the prayer in the earlier
oh gosh, I'm blanking on it right now,
but you know, it's the funeral hymn anyway.
Oh,
but
from the Orthodox,
yeah, from the Orthodox church,
the funeral rite,
the funeral rite. And there's this mourning quality to it, but then it ends with this triumphant thing. So he's clearly, you know, showing a sense of mourning, and then wants to have this triumphal ending to sort of get back in the good graces of the party, but he does it in such a way that it has this forced quality to it. And I think, you know, just understanding that context, that historical context, you know, I agree with all your metronome mark and stuff, but even just that, I mean, you have to sort of figure out what is this real spirit of the piece and connect with that. So I you know, I find that's compelling to me for the slower tempo.
And I think that this thing for me, like, you can take your tempo based on that. You know, whatever your tempo is when you have this bum 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 bum, whether you choose to go bum 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 bum. I mean, it's just they have a direct route.
I never thought about that really.
Yeah. But anyway, I just
we've got to
move on. But I just wanted to mention that thing about the historical part, because it really,
that's really important to remember the context in which it was written. There was this intentionally ironic, forced celebration kind of thing.
It feels that way.
Yeah. Okay.
Prokofiev 5.
Last one.
1944, I believe?
Yeah.
Yeah. In the midst of World War II. Okay, favorite moment?
The tam-tam at the end of the first movement.
Oh, man.
Yeah, you know, when they do the...
Bomb.
Yeah.
Bum, it just keeps going.
Bum, 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 bam. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be, like, as big as the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dance.
It just sounds like just this huge mechanization that's just obliterating everything. It almost feels like too much, and then you realize, oh, it's in the midst of this nightmarish war.
Yeah.
And things are not going well for the Russians. Or anybody, really, at that point.
Yeah,
well, actually, the Allies
he never left Russia, is that true?
Oh, he did leave Russia, but he went back.
Yeah. Okay.
That's kind of the tragedy. He went back, I believe, right around the time Stalin came to power.
Okay.
So he was out and then went back, and he was there for the worst part of it. And, of course, he died the same day as Stalin.
He did.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he was there for the worst of it.
Yeah.
Which is a really tragic.
It's kind of the story of his life.
In fact, that's the biography. It's, I think, Prokofiev, A Soviet Tragedy is the actual name of the biography.
My favorite moment's the end, because it sounds like a freight train that just keeps going. And there's these horns, you know, the trumpets. And, you know, another movements. And then at the end, it's just, Matt, you and I were talking about this before. We were just this low trumpet. And it's over. That's it.
It's like confetti.
Oh, it's so good.
Mm.
People love this. I mean, it just destroys you. It's like Mahler in a way. It's like the symphony's a whole world.
You know, I also think that the beginning of the last movement is very, very John Williams-esque in the way that he like it kind of like reminds me of
the
like
the way around.
like E.T. Like E.T. You know, like, you know, he has this da 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 da. Like a key change that just like seems like something out of E.T. Like you see him like, you know, flying by the moon.
Well, John Williams borrows from the best.
He does.
We all know this.
Yeah, are you saying that the cello chorale at the beginning of the fourth movement is E.T.?
No, sorry.
Bringing back the theme from the first movement.
Yeah.
Now we're...
Yeah.
The cellos are flying off in space.
Well...
It's where they belong.
All right, guys. Well, we got to wrap things up. Thank you so much again for coming out and hanging out in the front yard with us. It's a lot of fun. Exactly. And I think, Matt, we'll save the rants for another week.
We'll save the rants for next time.
All right. Yeah. So we're going to...
We've ranted enough, I think.
We have. And this has been just nothing but an epic nerd moment.
The whole thing was a rant and a nerd combined.
Fair enough.
We got the coffee in, though.
Fair enough. All right. Well, thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Brandon.
And,
thanks, Matt. Thanks, Ashkan.
Thank you.
Thanks, yeah, we'll have you guys back again. We'll do Rap-a-Palooza. It'll be a regular thing. And we'll have the Beethoven show coming up soon.
Oh, yeah.
So be looking for that. All right. Well, anyway, thanks, everybody. And thanks for listening. And until next week, we'll be back in the front yard.
This has been Conductor's Brew with Larry, Matt, and crew.
And here's the crew.
All right. Here's the crew.
Bye, everybody.
Later.